Reading from the Brihad Bhagavatam, to chapter 7, text 57. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Tishtan Samhara Tat Tishtan Tati Palaya Sampati Yajyam Pati Sasenyasya Samarajasya Santanu. Now please destroy the wicked and protect everyone else. Your cousin Dhamaraj, King Yudhisthira, has undertaken a sacrifice. Please see to getting it performed. Commentary. Balaram here requests Krishna to think of himself as the Lord of Vaikuntha, and of Balaram as his aid and not the station. Even though Krishna is indeed the son of Nanda Maharaj, he should now carry out the mission for which he and Balaram have descended from Vaikuntha. Of course, they had actually descended from Goloka Vrindavan, but Goloka and Vaikuntha are in many respects non-different. When Krishna descends to this world, he brings within himself all of his personal expansions, including the Lord of Vaikuntha. Thus, when he comes from Goloka, he is simultaneously coming from Vaikuntha. Krishna's main purpose for descending is to distribute the special kind of pure love found only at his own lotus feet by playing his pastimes in Vrindavan Dham. Dwarka is not the suitable place for this purpose. If Krishna turns his mind to the main objective, Balaram thinks, he is likely to become completely unsettled again. Therefore, Balaram calls Krishna Vaikuntheshwari instead of Golokeshwari, and tactfully points out that Krishna's current task is to relieve the earth of its burden by destroying evildoers and protecting law-abiding citizens. Most immediately, Yudhisthira needs Krishna's support for the Rajasuya Yajna. After achieving these secondary aims, Balaram implies, Krishna will be free to absorb himself in his first aim without impediment. Om Jnana Kumarandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Tatsu Rindavatam Yena Taismai Sri Gurudeva Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manovishnam Tatitam Yena Bhutale Sayam Rupa Kadamayam Kadati Swapadantikam Kancha Kapa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasudeva Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So greetings from Vrindavan. If any of you think of visiting Vrindavan, I think this is one of the most ideal times. I like those times where you can exchange with the residents. Very hard to access a holy place. We personally feel we have no qualification to do so. But we visit the holy place because there are people there that can access it. And through their association and mercy, we also can enter. That's my own personal feeling. Just after lunch, I take a walk down the back road and ran into Bhuri John Prabhu. He's teaching the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam 4 hours a day. So blissful. Happy to see me. I was happy to see him. Yesterday I got a call from Srimati that she wanted to see me and touch base, but I made a point to go see her because her room is the spiritual world personified. And that's real spiritual life. It's Sadhu Sangha. Sadhu Sangha. Sadhu Shastri Hoy, Sadhu Sangha, Sadhu Sangha, Sadhu City Hoy. That even a little association with someone who's advanced can give us perfection. I many times mentioned that on the bhakti path, the tracks on which the our advancement of bhakti moves is the Sadhu Sangha, the association with devotees that are more advanced than us, who are like-minded with us, and who have affection for us. Now we're in the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, and as I said, I sense we have a pretty steady audience here, and I could actually cover the story of the text. I do feel the need to make it somewhat contextual. The basic premise of the book is the great devotee Narada's search for the topmost recipient of Krishna's mercy. Meditate a second and close your eyes and go into your heart. What would it be like to receive Krishna's full mercy? What would it feel like? What would you understand from it? Krishna's full mercy is himself. It's his love for us. It's his acceptance of us as his servants. There's nothing higher than that. Because that is the position where the heart is filled with the most love and happiness. And what is happiness? It's bhakt-anand. It's the happiness of devotion. And bhakt-anand is the essence of the Supreme's bliss potency, the essence of his internal potency, which God enjoys by putting outside himself into the hearts of his devotees. Of course, nothing is outside of God. But within that one living harmonious whole, the discrimination, the distinction is there, so that God can put his potency outside himself into the hearts of his devotees who want to serve him. And that flow of energy, when the heart is filled with that energy, then one has the maximum love and one has the maximum happiness. And that's who we want to associate with. Prabhupada's godbrother, Srila Bhakti Rakshaka Sridhar Maharaj, makes a very, very simple analogy about spiritual life. He calls God the positive, because God has everything. And we're the negative, because we're in want of everything. The negative attracts the positive. And when the negative attracts the positive, then the negative can give the positive. So a devotee who has cleaned his heart of selfishness, has emptied his heart of any separate interest, creating the negative, the need, then he attracts God within his heart. And that person can give God. When the negative attracts the negative can give the positive. And that's real spiritual life. That's why spiritual life begins with humility. Humility is that consciousness that empties the heart of false conceptions of egotism. And humility is the quality of the Vaishnava. And such a person is such a beautiful thing. It's such a beautiful thing. The person who, rather than sees himself in the center, sees himself on the periphery, sees himself as the servant of everyone else. Dasa, 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 anudasa. One is the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant. Great devotees are in that mood. They don't want to be aggrandized, because that humble mood of service is the receptacle which holds the devotional potency in their heart. If they move to egotism, they move to these standing where that potency can no longer flow in their heart. So the Vaishnava is moving away from the center. He's moving to the position of service. And when he has that position of service, and devotion fills his heart, there's so much happiness and pleasure in that heart that he resists moving in any other direction. That's why in the Bhagavatam, when any Vaishnava is praised, and saying, you are great, you are the best, they resist it, because they have attained that happiness of service, which is the dust of the lotus feet of Krishna. which is a greater pleasure than even the sovereignty over the whole world, than liberation or anything else. And therefore, they're happy in that position. And therefore, when they're praised or glorified, they deflect that praise. And that's what's happening in the Bhagavatamrita. In Narada's search, whenever he designates one as in that position, they deny it. And they point to someone else. Anyway, in this journey, Narada is now in Dwarka, where Krishna, who is left Vrindavan, has come to be the king. And let's get up to our story right now. I think we're all familiar with it. Krishna in separation from the residents of Vrindavan had fainted, lost consciousness, knowing that the cause was the separation he was feeling from the residents of Vrindavan. Lord Brahma brings him and hatches the plan to bring him to New Vrindavan, where Vishvakarma has made an exact replica of Vrindavan with all details. And now in this part of the story, Krishna has been revived. And he's still in the illusion that he's in Vrindavan. There's so many beautiful parts of this story. It's just like when the queens who hide behind the trees, they see Krishna open his heart to what he thinks are the gopis, and they become even more attracted to Krishna than ever before, because it's the full manifestation of his beauty, which is his personality. Isn't a person's beauty their personality? And when the personality is beautiful, the personality is nothing. Isn't that what a beautiful personality is? It's a personality that is loving. It's a personality that is selfless. So the beauty of God's personality is his love, his full love. And when they actually see that heart fully, they become even more attractive. Anyway, Krishna goes and he thinks he's late to taking out the cows, and then this mother Vrindavan is on the Arabian Sea, and he thinks it's to Jamuna, but also the city of Dwarka is on the Arabian Sea, and he sees the city of Dwarka, and now he's bewildered a little bit, because he's not sure what's going on. What is this? Where am I? Who am I? As he noticed, a great city in the distance. And he kept on saying that, where am I? What is this? Who am I? And he's looking at this ocean and this vast city. And Balaram replies, Vaikunteshvara. He doesn't want to say Golokeshwara because that indicates the other Vrindavan, and he wants to bring him out now of that consciousness of the Lord of Vrindavan, now that his separation has been satisfied in the illusion that he was in Vrindavan had brought him out of his mood of separation because he thought it was real. So he got to experience the love for the residents of Vrindavan. But now, Balaram feels it's necessary that he has to remember the truth at the time that he's the king of Dwarka, because there's a primary and secondary reason for the appearance of Krishna. The primary reason is for him to exhibit his Vrindavan pastimes, which invokes spontaneous love for him, which is called Kevala Bhakti. It's only devotion. And when he manifests himself as God, it's not Kevala Bhakti, it's not only devotion, because mixed in that pure devotion is the sense of God's majesty, which creates a sense of obligation and reverence and fear. So Krishna comes in his Swayam Bhagavan, his full manifestation of Godhead, Akhila Rasa Nita Murti, as Krishna, to invoke that love, which is most forceful, which doesn't have the sense of obligation or duty, because Krishna comes as a coward, right? But now Balaram wants to bring him back to that consciousness, because the secondary reason for Krishna appearing is yada yada hi dharma syavan, when there's a discrepancy in religion, dharma, then the Supreme Lord comes to establish dharma. Dharma means basically that which moves one towards one's original position, I had a favorite statement, now I forgot it. The original position of the original position of the devotee is called the devotee. We are devotees. That's our eternal position. We're part of God, and we're made to serve and love God. And in loving God, we're meant to share in God's own pleasure, which is bhakti. So, dharma are various principles which move us closer to surrender to God, and adharma are those principles which move us away. So when there's a discrepancy in those principles, the Supreme Lord appears. So now he's telling them, this is the reason that you've come, and first do this, then you can absorb yourself in your Vrindavan pastimes. Patishtitas Sayavasa Chakravati Yudhisthira Anishalvari Dushtanam Padeti Vara Vikramat. You have established Yudhisthira as emperor, but he is intimidated by Shalva's younger brother and by exceedingly powerful villains. Commentary: Yudhisthira will not dare face the challenge of staging the Rajasuya sacrifice unless Krishna encourages him. And several opponents, like King Anusalva, first need to be removed. Please, therefore, go to Yudhisthira and, with the help of the Yadus, try to kill his enemies who are persecuting your devotees out of hatred for you. So Balaram is trying to invoke within Krishna his spirit of valor so that he will embrace this mood of being the king and establishing dharma. Sri Parikshit said, Balaram spoke these words to change his younger brother's ecstatic mood and bring him back to normal. Indeed, upon hearing what Balaram said, Krishna did change his mood. Commentary. Before hearing these words, Krishna was swimming in the prema ras of the most confidential loving dealing, but now he was in heroic mood. Thus, in the next verse, Krishna will further his Bhagavan. So this is such a very interesting concept and understanding that there's one absolute reality. There's not many absolute realities. There's one absolute reality which has the ability to manifest to one according to one's relationship. Why should that be denied in the absolute? We ourselves manifest ourselves in different ways according to the relationship we have with people and according to their degree of love. So that one absolute reality manifests in various ways. What is that? Vedanta tat tatta vidas tatta yajnanam advayam vameti paramatmeti bhagavan iti shabdite. Gail knows this verse. She once recited it for me and explained its meaning. Vedanta tat tatta vidas. Vedanta tat tatta. What are those who know the absolute? They know that there's one absolute truth, advayam jnan, consciousness which is non-dual. And according to your perspective and approach and relationship, it can manifest in different ways. There's three aspects of the absolute truth. Brahman, the all-pervading aspect. Paramatma, the localized aspect. Bhagavan, the personal aspect. But it's one thing which includes all. Brahman is not a different absolute reality. It's also Krishna. But it's Krishna without qualities manifesting for those who want to perceive God in that way. Recently I had a very kind of interesting experience here in Vrindavan, as some of you know. I'm kind of like a point man. Constantly get letters, constantly, from people who want to see Vrindavan. And it's got so much to the extent that now I've trained up an assistant to help me. One young lady, she's really excellent. And sometimes now people even refer people to her. So she someone referred someone to her that I know. And then she said, "You really, this lady, once I told you, this lady, I know, she said, I'm the lady, there's a real, my teacher's there, he's a scholar, you should meet him." So I said, "Okay, bring her over." So this lady comes, and she's quite cultured, I would say, and very, very good mind, very disciplined, successful, but had this spiritual calling, never saw Vrindavan before. I don't think Rinpoche came on before either. But she came, and I talked to her, and it's very, very interesting. She already had a 2-hour practice. she's already initiated in another line, but somehow or other, I asked if you want me to teach you our meditation. And I led her to a guided meditation of the Hare Krishna mantra. And she immediately went into trance. Deep. Such an experienced meditator. She went into trance. And then she wanted the next day to take a vow of chanting. Anyway, she decided she would chant under my guidance 2 hours a day. And she had a very interesting experience, because she had other mantras. And her experience was, while other mantras may give you some experience, and some knowledge, and the different types of mantras, but the Hare Krishna mantra is a heart mantra. And she's right. It's a mantra that opens the heart. If done in a proper way, the heart is open to experience the mantra. And experiencing the mantra is experiencing your relationship with God. Because the mantra is Shabda Brahman. It's the absolute in sound. And I was guiding her this way to feel the mantra. Because feeling the mantra is what? It's experiencing your relationship with God. But still, obviously there was some impersonal concepts. It's definitely a realization one can have. But it's not the ultimate realization. Because love requires an exchange. An exchange requires a subject and object of the exchange. So the ultimate realization of the absolute reality has within that harmonious reality a type of discrimination for the purpose of the exchange of love. And that's called Shakti and Shakti Man. It's the energy and the possessor's energy in the exchange, which is called devotion or love. Let me just read on and see what it's speaking is a flow, and when the flow stops, I generally stop. But I'll just say one more thing of relevance, and I'll ask the questions. That's still my style. I'm now. I give class every day at 4 o'clock. This is also quite edifying. Very nice people come. And I'm discussing a chapter in Chaitanya Charitamrita called Ramananda Samvad. And, of course, it's a very beautiful text. And maybe I can just explain that. I think that'll be a bit better contribution for me today. Anyway, that's my inspiration. I do go by inspiration in this way. But just the concept of Chaitanya is very interesting. that for God to be complete in his own enjoyment, he has to become, take the position of his devotee. Because the devotee has three experiences that God does not have unless he's also the devotee. And that's the experience of love of God, the experience of God, and the experience of God's love. So the story of Chaitanya is the story of God searching for himself. And therefore, the story of Chaitanya is the example of the life we need to follow, because our life is also searching for God, and searching for God means to search for our relationship with God. Because our experience of God and what God is to us will depend on our relationship with God. It's like a person. A person is not one thing. A person may be a father, a person may be a son, a person may be a friend, a person may be a lover. But the person is a particular thing in relationship to us. He's a father to one person, he's a friend to another person. So searching for a person and searching for God means to search for our relationship with God. And that's the purpose of life, because that's the eternal position of a living entity. That's who we are by nature. When we get rid of everything that's external to the self, what are we? That's what spiritual life means. That's why even the days of yore, Kshatriyas, who were a bit passionate for meditation, but were great devotees, the great warriors, when they wanted liberation, at the end of their lives, when they saw that the body, the temporary body, was changing, and that soon they would have to leave it, in their valley, they would walk north. So what's the first thing they would do? They would take off their uniform. They would crack their sword. They would rip off their medals. Why? Because although that was part of their identity, and a part of their identity they needed to work through to become purified, ultimately that was external to the self. And then they would walk to the north, and it would be so much austerity. And gradually, everything external to the self would be gone until finally they would be able to rid themselves of the subtle covering of ahankara. So, when we rid ourselves of everything external to the self, then we're a devotee. We're a particle of consciousness meant to love the Supreme Consciousness. Anyway, in this story, because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, it's Krishna in the position of his devotee, and taking the position of his devotee because Krishna wants to experience love of Godhead. But Krishna doesn't have love of Godhead until he also is his devotee. So he doesn't have love of Godhead, so he has to get love of Godhead. So what does he do? He has to find guru. He has to find the negative which has attracted the positive and can give the positive. The persons who cleared their hearts in such a way that they filled their hearts with God, and filling your hearts with God means to fill your heart with love of God. So in this particular story that we're reading, And forgive me for going off with the Briyat Bhagavatamrita, but my inspiration is going here. In this wonderful story, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he doesn't manifest love of Godhead until he meets his guru, Ishwara Puri, and then he becomes transformed. And because he's a suitable receptacle, the transformation is complete at initiation. In other words, you may get something from a teacher, but you have to access it by your own consciousness also. And that's told so nicely in the story of Kaliya, because the serpent, all the heads represent the egotistical conception of life. I am the controller, I am the enjoyer. When by Krishna's dance, they're finally the last head cannot rise of egoism. And Kaliya is beaten to the extent that Kaliya cannot even talk. Smitva Kaliya remembers the instructions of his wives who were devotees and is able to assimilate them and surrender fully to Krishna. So this is the nature of instruction. Instruction is there. Instruction stays in the consciousness. But things have a tendency, because of false ego, to recede within the consciousness constantly. That's why we have to hear again and again. But when the false conception of life is finally frustrated, then we may remember, we may access those instructions. And therefore, when Lord Chaitanya takes initiation, and he's the full surrendered receptacle with the desire, the proper desire, the full mercy of his teacher, he's awakened at once, and he attains love of Godhead, and he becomes completely changed. And eventually, of course, after that, he takes sannyas. And then he goes on pilgrimage. And pilgrimage, traditional pilgrimage, has two aspects. One, you put yourself in a situation where you can fully absorb yourself in spiritual life without compromise, which is hard to do in our ordinary lives. And you make a vow that on this pilgrimage, my life will only be for the pleasure of God. And the other aspect of traditional pilgrimage is you give up your comforts and control. When one stays in a place for some time, gradually in the egotistical conception of life, the environment becomes organized to satisfy one's desires to enjoy and control. Unless one is exceptionally spiritual and puts God at the center of his life, which is why married people would have deities, to shift that orientation, the kitchen becomes Krishna's. The house becomes Krishna's. It's not that sense there. It's a shift. When one actually is Krishna conscious, everything is centered on others. It's centered on God. It's centered on the devotees. Unless that shift is there. But in pilgrimage, you can take the temporary shift. You get out of that environment, you depend on God. And in the traditional pilgrimage, one would walk. So what would happen? And especially not just pilgrimage, but Lord Chaitanya is not just pilgrimage, it's the time of his life where he decided to give himself completely to God. And what happens when you're in the forest and you take this type of situation, then where are you going to eat? Well, God provides the food, and then all of a sudden, it's there. All of a sudden, you find the berries on the bushes, or someone brings some milk, or whatever. It's completely... And when you feel that everything is provided by God, and you feel God's mercy, then the pilgrimage increases one's love of Godhead, even in terms of protection. And that's the sadhu. He's so firmly convinced that God is protecting him that he's not even afraid of a snake. Because he knows that God is in his heart, God's in the heart of the snake, and that the snake, or God's in the heart of the snake, will see the sadhu and protect him. In Jiva Dharma, when it describes the generation after Lord Chaitanya, when the Paramahamsas, the great souls, when the groves of Gojan Dweep, chanting 300,000 names a day, and one, it describes in this novel that one new person comes. And the first thing is that you have to be free from fear, otherwise you can't do bhajan. You can't do deep spiritual. You have to be free from fear, and you have to be free of fear from fear of snakes. It's the snakes in the village, the snakes in the forest, but you have to be calm. You have to be fit. So Lord Chaitanya goes on pilgrimage, and in that pilgrimage also he's visiting all these deities. It gives you a beautiful description of what was India, even more so when I was 35 years ago when I came. What a vision was India, the crystal clear rivers, and he's walking. And what is Lord Chaitanya doing? You can see what is the life of someone who's imbued with love of Godhead. And what is his life? Nityadana. He's chanting and dancing, and then he goes across the river, and then Nam Sankirtan, and he chants. And then he sees Ramananda Roy, who's a big government magistrate who has so many Brahmins that supervise his ritualistic bath. And then Lord Chaitanya sees Ramananda Roy. This is hagiography. I mean, it's written by the devotees. We also believe it's historical. And he sees Ramananda Roy. He sees him. And there's a natural attraction because there's an eternal relationship between them. Because Ramananda Roy is the chief gopi, the Shaka, in Krishna Lila, and Lord Chaitanya is Radha and Krishna. So there's a natural attraction. And that attraction is so intense because it's the full manifestation of love of Godhead. And very wonderful. I mean, there's so many parts to the story. But the attraction is so deep. And then they embrace and they begin rolling on the ground, and all the classical symptoms of the highest love of Godhead, tears from the eyes, paralysis, hair standing on end, what's called astika svetika bhavs, begin to manifest. And then they're rolling on the floor in ecstasy. And then the Brahmins are looking and puzzled because Ramananda Roy is a Maha Pandit. In fact, even though Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't have directions, he had this strong desire to meet Ramananda Roy because Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, the great scholar who he converted, told him that you have to meet Ramananda Roy. And he was looking for the Siksha Guru. The instruction, his guru gave him the conviction, his guru gave him the seed. But He wanted further instructions how to nourish that sentiment to the fulfillment of his ideal, was to completely be imbued in the heart with the mood of Srimati Radharani. Because this is what, it's Krishna, Chaitanya. He wants to experience himself, and he can only experience himself if he has the mood of Radharani, if he has the full love of Radharani, Radha. So he wants help to achieve that ideal. The seed, the conviction, was put in his heart by his guru to a very strong degree. And he surrendered immediately, and he was changed completely. But now, to nourish it to the full ideal of the highest love called Mahabhav, he needed the instructions of a great teacher, and that was Ramananda Roy. But he had no plan, but by the sincerity and depth of his heart, he was carried in that direction, which is actually how spiritual life works. Spiritual, we can't do things externally to achieve our ideals. But if we develop the deep desire in our hearts for the highest ideal, then that deep desire in the heart for the highest ideal will carry us to those people who have that ideal. You can't do it on a map. It won't work, because even if you meet those people, you will not have relationship with them, because it won't be dictated by the transcendental system. And that's what the whole Brihad Bhagavatamrita is. Narada Muni has that ideal. He has the highest ideal. He has the best ideal. And the best ideal is he wants to meet that soul whose heart is filled with love. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't have plan. He didn't have mechanics. He had ideal. And he had strong ideal. And now he's met that ideal in the form of Ramananda Roy. And there's such an internal connection with them. And so what happens is the ritualistic Brahmins are looking. They do not have a frame of reference to understand this. Especially in spiritual life, one is careful what he talks about and what he exhibits in public, even if it's true, if those people don't have the frame of reference to understand it. Rather, they can misunderstand it and commit offense. And therefore, generally, in the talks of Radha and Krishna and the intimate pastimes of Radha and Krishna, they're not talked about in places where they can be misunderstood as mundane or mythological. But they're spoken in places where people, by the cultivation of spiritual knowledge and practice, have matured to the level where they will understand it as the highest reality of selfless and pure love. Of course, Prabhupada showed us that an expert teacher, such as himself, can do both. Present the highest ideals, but couched simultaneously in a frame of reference to inoculate people from misunderstanding. What a wonderful thing. He did that with the Krishna book. But these Brahmins, these ritualistic Brahmins, are looking, and what are they thinking? They're thinking, Ramananda Roy is a Mahapandit. Why is he acting like a madman? And what is a Mahapandit? It's one with buddhi. Buddhi or intelligence is the function of the mind that can digest experiences. So one can understand them appropriately and respond to them appropriately. So some of these Mahapandit is very learned because of the digestive power of his intelligence. He's generally sober. He generally doesn't lose control of himself. And that's why a jnani is very dry. Of course, there are appropriate emotions that are instilled in the consciousness. But the pandits had no frame of reference to understand this high manifestation of bhakti. Rather, because they weren't bhaktis and they didn't have frame of reference and didn't have understanding of it, to their understanding, it looked strange. Like a Mahapandit, a great scholar, was acting frivolously, emotionally. And they couldn't understand, because although Ramananda Roy was in that royal position, but actually he was born as a Sudra. And a king is Vishayi. Anyone who's in a government position, especially in a monarchy, he has to exhibit the accoutrements of power, because that's what the populace respects. And therefore they become servile to the greatness of power, which is why traditionally kings had palaces and thrones and crown jewels. Even if they were a saintly king, even if they were detached, they would exhibit the accoutrements of power to help them rule. Even in England now, somehow or other, the king and queen, there's still some respect. And a ruler would rather rule by a spirit of cooperation than a spirit of force. So if power and the accoutrements of power can inspire that cooperation, they'll use it. But traditionally, a sannyasi therefore wouldn't even associate with a king who is saintly, because he had to act as an enjoyer. He had harems, he had opulence, and they wouldn't associate. So here was this, Chaitanya was this monk, intimately embracing this Roy, this king, who's in the role of a king. So they couldn't understand it. They didn't have the frame of reference. And therefore, when Lord Chaitanya, even though he's in this emotional state, he had some sense, then he stopped. He said, because they're not swajit here, they're not basically the same. Anyway, the part we're up to, and it's such a nice crowd that comes there every day. And we have really nice kirtans too, before and after. But it's a very, very nice crowd. And we're up to the part now where they finally meet privately. And then Lord Chaitanya asked Ramananda Roy that Pada Shloka Sadhyara Nirnoy, please ascertain the verse in the scriptures that indicates the goal. And then there will be progressive answers, and ultimately that will be revealed. So anyway, I shared that with you today. Would anyone let's put it this way. I'm going to do something now. 1 second. So I unmuted everyone. So would someone like to say hello?
Marge, I had a question, actually. Is there time?
Okay, Mahamuni, go ahead.
You had earlier mentioned, Marge, that there's a way in which people who approach bhakti practice, they may feel a kind of powerful emotional transformation, but they may not actually connect it to loving God or loving a person or connect. And, you know, I haven't been around it that much, but I have seen in among people who are kind of attracted to yoga and kirtan and stuff like that, sometimes they'll talk about bhakti, and it seems like what they're talking about is like a subjective emotion and not a relationship. And I was wondering if, do you think this is healthy, that it's kind of moving them towards bhakti, or do you think it's a kind of spiritual disease where even bhakti becomes a kind of narcissistic self-pleasure?
You know, I think what people lack today, this is what I'm experiencing, right? And I saw this with this girl, you know, that they don't have a very clear conception. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have a very clear conception. So it's kind of almost like a soul that really wants to give themselves to God, but they have a definition which denies it ultimately, but they don't even realize it.
Mm.
You know, and I think you can't put it as one thing, you know, because also even that type of experience of the non-realization, you know, I mean, look, there's so many things that are going on. There's narcissistic people, right, that have just something emotional. Then there's people that have a budding sense of devotion and they're actually contacting something, you know. Then there are impersonal people that actually have some kind of experience, you know, which they have an experience, you know. And what that experience will be depends even on their thing. You know, there's a meditation, at least in yoga, where, you know, you go beyond the object, you know, and you're realizing prakriti and there's some happiness there. So you don't know what level of the mind it is, what level of transcendence it is. So what I say to you, then there certainly may be a category of people like that. But I think it's a very, very diverse. Like, for example, this girl who's incredible meditator, you know, she is from Russia. She was 10 years in New York, you know, very educated person. And, you know, she'd always go, and she'd like to go to the monasteries, the nunneries of the Russian Orthodox Church. You know, and this is what I told her, actually, because she wasn't under, you know, I don't push what I believe. I just say what the difference is. You know, there's just another conception, and this is why we have that conception. But ultimately, I told her when she couldn't understand, I said, look, you came through an impersonal path, and through that path, because yoga is the school of Indian philosophy that deals with psychology. There was a transformation of the mind. There was an experience beyond your perception, even if it was the mode of goodness, it's beyond your categorization, and you know. And therefore, you trusted the people who gave you that conception. And because their conception is that things were undifferentiated oneness, which, as you know, is really the minority view by far in Indian spiritual thought,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you had that conception, right, then you accept it, but it's not really that it's logical in your mind. You've accepted by authority. And now that you're feeling some experience here in this other tradition, she's feeling by taking to the mantra and really wanting to offer herself to God, even not, she's actually having some spiritual experience, I say now you just have to pray to God to reveal to you, you know, what your path is. But the point I'm making is I think it's a variety of people. Not, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think it's a good point.
Yeah, but right, and especially I think with people who really want to give themselves, you know, it's not just their mixed in with everyone is searching for some pleasure. So that's a motive that comes in there. But there's an understanding to give yourself and give up the ego, and you know, and give yourself there. So, but the thing that get you know is really interesting, right? When you explain to someone logically, right, that you know when you have a conception of oneness, right, then you deny beauty and you deny love. You know. Because those are qualities that you're ascribing to the absolute reality, you know, and already there, they, when you say that, then they say, well, okay, that's logic. You can't, you know, it can't be described by words, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know where that leads, right? But then you can say, well, even if I say the absolute reality is a, you know, a midget, right, then that makes as much sense as saying it has no qualities.
Yeah, right. And also, then they have to stop saying that the absolute reality is one. Sorry, I think, Marge, the lack of muting on the phones, it's hard. Did you hear what I said or no?
Oh, I did.
Yeah, so they're not even allowed to say that it's one anymore. They can't even say that it's one anymore if they really want to claim that we can't use language and we can't use logic.
Uh-huh.
Sorry,
you can't
Mark.
Say it's one anymore.
They just have to stop talking. They just need to shut up because at this point, if words don't work and logic doesn't work, then a word like oneness, to understand what oneness means relies on the understanding the relationship between numbers and the difference between 2 and 3 and 4 and 1. But what is that if not logical relations? To be one means not to be two.
And if you say it has no qualities, that's also a quality, isn't it, or not?
I think so, in the sense that it's a kind of description which we can apply to Brahman. I mean, they may debate that point, but I think that
okay.
I think the biggest issue is if language and thought does not reach Brahman, then really they have no business saying anything. Marsh, sorry,
yeah,
is it getting too difficult?
Yeah. No, I'm muted again. Okay. Mooney?
Maraj?
How people are saying you think. Yeah.
There's one other thing you said that I thought really struck me about certain kinds of Advaitins or, you know, Mayavadis, that they kind of have this idea that bhakti is for emotional people and Advaita is, and like the jnana path is for people who are really more rigorous in their kind of intellectual life. But then when you, but some of them at least, when you confront them with the problems that you brought up, it actually shows how anti-intellectual they are. And how, in one sense, their relationship with Brahman is also emotional. If they want to claim that they can experience love, but without anybody to love, and you point out that there's something about that that's incoherent, and they say, well, we just don't understand it, well, they might as well just be prattling on, you know, bhakti emotionalists or whatever. It's a weird kind of, I feel like, inconsistency on their part. Anyway, I don't want to drag on,
right.
I appreciate your...
Yeah, love is exchange. Nice to see you on again. Okay. Anybody else
Thank
like
you,
to say okay. anything else? Okay. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna? Okay, 1 second, I'm gonna unmute.
Krishna Maharaj.
Anybody like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hi, Bogil.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hello. That's Chaitanya Priya. I hear Gail. See, what I did is I unmuted everyone because people say they can't say hello sometimes. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
This is who? Hello?
This is Rajrade.
Who? Who is that?
This is Rajrade Devdasa.
Oh, Rajrade. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hello, Mara.
Is that Mother and Johnny? This is the open mode, so I hear everybody's phone at once. You probably can't hear anybody, but anyway, I'm trying it. Anybody else like to say hello? Who is it? Who? Who is it? Hare Krishna, who's that?
Hi.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Who's that?
Carl and Stella.
Hi, Bo. See you soon, Carl.
All right. Hare Krishna.
I'll be here waiting for you.
Can't wait.
Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances.
Hello, Nandi Dulal.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Great. Anybody else?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, it's Anand.
Hare Krishna, thank you. Thank you. Somehow today I just didn't get the inspiration to continue to be a Bhagavatam because I hope people appreciated just sharing what we're doing in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj, Jaini Thai here.
From Tucson, Jaini Thai?
Tucson, Jaini Thai.
Okay, Hare Bol.
Hare Krishna.
My regards to the family. Hare Bol. Anybody else like to say hi, Krishna? Hello? Okay. Hi, Krishna. Thanks for coming on. I just